For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. It's my pleasure to, again, this evening introduce Myogen Steve Stuckey, the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, of all three of the wonderful campuses of San Francisco Zen Center, and I'm just so delighted to have him here to and recognize our connection as an affiliate temple of San Francisco Zen Center. Nancy, there's room for a chair right next to the door there. I just also wanted to mention, which I didn't mention when I introduced him yesterday morning, that Steve, along with four other monks, saved Sasahara Monastery 2 summers ago from being burnt by a fire. The heroic story of how they, saved a fire coming into Sasahara from all directions will be in a book next year. And do we know who's playing you in the movie yet? Anyway, it's a great honor to have Steve here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and welcome everyone. And Steve, thank you for speaking to us.
Welcome, everyone. Are there some people here for the first time? For me, it's the second time. So I'm happy to be here and enjoy sitting zazen with everyone. So mostly what I want to say is in support of a practice of sitting with the intention of simply being aware of things as it is. When we were talking about what should be a topic, usually I don't have a topic, but Tygon wanted a topic a few weeks ago when we were talking about what should I talk about. So somehow I came up with nirvana, samsara. What's the difference? I don't know if these words mean anything to people. Does everyone know what nirvana is? Some people are nodding their heads.
That's a trick question. Maybe.
I was going to, invite you to give the talk. How about samsara? Does everyone know what samsara is?
Oh, yeah.
So I was thinking today about samsara, actually. What do we mean by that? My definition for tonight is perpetuating entanglements. Samsara is perpetuating entanglements. Entanglements of belief, or what someone is holding on to. Even maybe something very good that you believe to be true. So then nirvana would be cessation or release from the bondage of those beliefs and those entanglements. So that may sound kind of abstract, I don't know. Suzuki Roshi's wife, Mitsu, would come to Green Gulch Farm after he died, and she would write haiku And so one of the haiku at Green Gulch that she wrote at Green Gulch goes like this. This was in the summer haiku, and it goes, bean sprouts straight, nothing to grasp, burning sun. So I really feel inspired by that haiku. Bean sprout straight. This is, I think, her haiku inspired by sitting upright. And noticing that bean sprouts already know how to grow upright and have no desire to be anything other than a bean sprout, because they have no desire to be anything other than a bean sprout. There's nothing to grasp, and there's a complete willingness to be present in the intensity of burning sun. So bean sprout straight, nothing to grasp. There's a tendency for us to want to get involved in feeling that I am doing things, and I am doing things with some sense of importance, something that must be done, should be done. And so there's this way in which the mind of ego, or the mind of I or me, then gets caught. There's a story of a dialogue that you probably, many of you may be familiar with. One Zen monk who was sweeping. Zen monks it's a good thing. It's considered to be good if you're Zen monk that you're sweeping, you know, or raking. Raking is good too. It's said that Zen is basically two things, just sitting Zazen and tending the garden. So if you're not sitting Zazen, then you should be tending the garden. It doesn't matter what size, big garden, small garden. There's always something to do in the garden, and it could be raking or sweeping. But anyway, Yunyan was sweeping the garden, and his elder brother, monk, actually, came up and said, too busy. And Yunyan said, you should know there's one who's not busy. Dawu said, in that case, is there a second moon? Yunyan held up his broom, said, which moon is this? And Dawu stopped pestering him. So this, to me, is a very interesting dialogue. And it's been something that I worked with. And when I lived in Santa Fe, California, I had a little zendo in the back. We had the house in the front, and then we turned there was a driveway that went to the back, and in the back there was a garage, a carport that we converted into a zendo. About this size, actually. So, I did some garden and had a little stream that came down, and then there was a little bridge that you cross over. So I told people we named the bridge Not Busy Bridge, with the thought that whenever you cross the bridge, you are reminded, busy? not busy. Where are you with this matter of busy, not busy? So we could say that busy would be referring to this notion of samsara, the perpetuating entanglements. What does it mean then when someone is busy sweeping and at the same time says there's one not busy? Can you and yourself have some sense of, okay, when in the midst of activity, busy sweeping, busy taking out the trash, busy cooking dinner, going to work, teaching the children, is there also an understanding of one not busy? So this is a question that then looks like maybe, okay, there's a duality here. There's one busy and there's one not busy. So Dao Wu says, does that mean there's a second moon? Second moon. Is there some other place? Is there some other universe? Are you not actually doing this? Is it possible to be sweeping and not doing? So this really, really depends. For Yunyan to say, okay, let's get right down to it. What moon is this? This is a broom. But he didn't say this is a broom. He said, what is this? So usually we'd say, okay, it's something, it's a broom. You're doing something. You are doing something. Sweeping. But he says, can you make it immediate? If you make it immediate, what is this? So when you make it immediate, you drop off all the notions of, let's say, comparative thinking. So I think this is a characteristic of our Zen way, to attend to what's most immediate. Really pay attention to what's most immediate. And when you pay attention to what's most immediate, you begin to see that the usual way of thinking about things, of conceiving of things, is not quite right. Shakyamuni Buddha, we have Shakyamuni Buddha up here and raised up in the middle. Shakyamuni Buddha was always pointing out that it's good to pay attention to things and see how people get caught in samsara, how human beings get caught in perpetuating entanglements. If you don't pay close attention, you don't even notice how you perpetuate entanglements. So part of our practice is to stop. Notice the way the mind is wanting to perpetuate old habits. Habits that then get more deeply, rutted in the brain. And then it's harder and harder to be free of them. When you pay very close attention, you may notice that there isn't any, there isn't exactly some separation between your perception of something and the thing. You may notice that the perception of the thing and the thing are one, that there is no thing without your perception. And there's no you without the thing. This is happening all the time, that all of our senses are opened up and receiving. The only world that we really know is what we experience. So we're paying more closer and closer attention to that. So this is body practice, taking care of the body, noticing some feeling with this experience and how we sense things. So early on, Buddha was teaching about how things, there's cause and effect. Someone does something and then there's some consequence, there's some effect. But then it's not quite as simple as that. There's a teaching of Kacchanagota, who came and asked the Buddha about how do we really see things? What can you say about right view? And the Buddha, Shakyamuni, said, most people think that things exist. But then there are other people who think, they've been really thinking about it, and they think things don't exist. What I teach is the middle way. Not getting caught with existence or non-existence. Middle way, not things exist and not things don't exist. Today, Taigen and I were visiting another Zen teacher, Joshin, out in Oak Park, and he had a bumper sticker on his wall that said, honk if you don't exist. Make quite a racket. So it's good to have this question, what is this? Is there busyness? Is there a second moon? Is there a second moon of non-existence? So sometime after Shakyamuni Buddha lived, there was a teacher, an Indian Buddhist named Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna began this treatise of many verses in which he argued very closely to show how all the usual ideas of things are not quite right. The usual ideas of things really cannot be supported if you look at them so closely. So he started off, there are various translations, but he started off this whole treatise of many, many verses by saying that things don't cause themselves, and things are not caused by another. Things are not caused by a combination of themselves and others. And also things are, there's that nothing exists that is not caused. So when I was teaching this at Tassajara, it upset some people. Because we have these t-shirts that say, deep faith in cause and effect. Cultivate deep faith in cause and effect. And so then I, this is quite a bind, actually. Quite a bind for people's minds. And I came up with a little blues version of this, if I can remember it. It's nothing is caused by itself, nothing is caused by another, nothing is caused by a father, nothing is caused by a mother, nothing is caused by the sun, nothing is caused by the moon, nothing is really happening, but it's happening much too soon. You know what it gets me? It gets me down to my shoes. It's nothing but the Mula Majama Kakarika blues. So the blues are quite a relief, aren't they? Beautiful cup. So, Nagarjuna is ruthless in pointing out that things don't exist in the usual way we think they exist. Suzuki Roshi, if many of you are familiar with the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and in the chapter on emptiness, he says, if you want to understand Buddhism, you first have to get rid of your preconceived ideas. Preconceived ideas, particularly ideas about things existing substantially. That things exist, I think that's what he says, exist substantially. If you are willing to take a look at how you conceive of things, you may begin to see that there's a way in which the experience that you have that's flooding your whole body and mind through all of your senses gets substantialized. How does it get turned into concrete things? And to take full responsibility for that actually is our practice. That means to take it completely into account that we are always, we have to do this actually, we have to keep substantializing things. We have to keep saying, okay, floor, right? Time or very little. Someone saying, oh, this is floor. Yeah. Fall down on the floor. Stand up from the floor. But then do you realize there's no floor? It's a sound. And then we begin, oh yeah, that sound, and we interpret it. Oh, there's a sound of the stick hitting the floor. But there's a meaning there, and the sound is actually simply sound. Sound comes into the ears. So we have a practice. I actually suggest to take up the practice of just hearing sound as sound. It's wonderful to sit bathed in sound and notice the tendency to want to create stories about it, to name the sources, to hold on to various interpretations. And it's okay to do that. It's good to know what your mind does. It's good to appreciate the way the mind actually takes hold of things. When you see how the mind takes hold of things, then you can also see how the mind can release things. And you can see that you can see emptiness. In other words, you can see things before they take a particular concreteness. When you see that things are not exactly what you make them out to be, there's a kind of freedom. when someone walks into the room, even if it's an old friend or even if it's someone that you're married to, when my wife walks into the room, do I think I know who it is? It's actually much more honest in to not know who she is. Now, who is this walking into the room? If I think I know who she is already, then I have a kind of a prejudice, a kind of bias. And I'm perpetuating certain beliefs, entanglements. So what about not knowing who's walking into the room, even when it's an old friend? And it's the same, that means that when someone who you've never seen before walks into the room, you can also greet them as an old friend. So I think it's a wonderful thing when, with a sangha like this, is right on the street, the Dragon Gate. People come through the Dragon Gate, Ryomon. People come through the Dragon Gate and immediately they're old friends, completely unknown old friends, being willing to meet them. So usually we're trying to protect ourselves from the experience of not knowing. Experience of not knowing is scary. We'd much rather know what's going on. Know who I am, know who you are. Yeah. But then we're always shocked when things aren't the way we think they are. We tend to kind of accumulate an idea of how things are, and then we're shocked when, oh, it turns out differently. Something different happens. So this practice takes a lot of courage, actually, tremendous courage, to be able to endure the release of what you believe. Endure the pain of letting go of something that you are holding onto. And you may not even know what you're holding onto until something comes up and then you notice that you have some reaction to it, and that reaction tells you, oh, I must be believing something. I must be expecting something. Because I don't like this. Or maybe you do like it. Oh, I really like this. This is exactly what I wanted, or exactly what I thought. Either way, it kind of gets, it's kind of like Velcro, you know. And then when it turns out to be different, then it's kind of like that tearing it away. Or like a bandage it's on, a little bandage. And it's peeled away. It's a little bit painful. So then you know, okay, oh, I have, now I know, I had some belief. Can I accept that it's now lost, gone? So this is a kind of grieving. Being willing to stay present with the pain of the moment that just happened is gone. The person I thought I knew is gone. We usually associate grieving with some major loss, you know, like someone dies. And we don't notice that someone's always dying. So this is a refinement of our intelligence, a refinement of our capacity to really see things as it is. And Zazen practice, sitting, gives you more and more, say, capacity. You don't have to do anything special. Just sit. And if you sit and notice that you're squirming, then see if you can let go of that squirming. Squirming in the body and squirming in the mind. So I tell people, you don't have to hold still. It's not holding still, but it's letting go of the desire to move. The desire even to be slightly someplace else. And as you do that, you actually become more and more completely present. Just completely present. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to actually be present for your life. And you have all kinds of possibilities then. So as you refine this, you may notice that there's not much difference between samsara and nirvana. Because samsara is not moving away from what you don't like and not holding on to what you do want. So, and that means that you're being willing to be fully present with what you don't like. And you're willing to be fully present with the desire to do something or to get something. And the full experience of that is known. And the freedom that you have is not to do anything about it. To be fully aware of it. To be fully aware of it means you have complete, you actually have a choice then. You can do something or not. So, at that moment, you're not perpetuating entanglements. Entanglements actually don't exist because you're no longer holding, you're no longer pushing away. So with that, there's a spacious feeling. So when you have a spacious feeling, don't hold on to it. Just accept, oh, okay. You don't even have to say spacious feeling. As soon as you say, oh, I'm having spacious feeling, uh-oh. So in this practice, we don't try to go anywhere except be fully present. So whether it's a spacious feeling or an excruciatingly intense feeling, it's really no difference. It's just what you're feeling. So maybe I've talked about enough. And there's time for questions, yeah?
Yes.
So thank you for listening, and I'm wondering if this is clear, or there's some other comments you have.
Scott.
Yes.
Scott.
So the person behind you can be next, but you, okay. You're no, right here. The person on the floor.
Scott on the
person
floor.
Person on the floor.
If you can wait, Jeff. Yeah.
No.
Okay. No, there's a. It's funny you mentioned how, say your wife walked into the room, and do I know her? Then you're already judging, and you're already looking at something in a certain way that ruins everything. There's a little short story that I was reading in the book, and it was talking about where there was a lady who was going to get married to this guy, and this guy was in love with her. He thought he was in love with her, and she had a lot of money, and she had a lot of estate. So in order for her to let this guy marry her, because she had strong feelings for him too, but she had all this land, so she wanted to have a house over here for him and a house over here for her. And she said, maybe you'll be strolling around, walking through, you know, the trail, and you might stumble upon me working in my garden or, you know, watering the flowers. And you can come up and say, hi, would you like to get some tea? Or, you know, just... And she said, and pretty much saying, you know what, you might stumble upon me somewhere else at the grocery store. we're bound to bump into each other. We live right by each other. So... But the thing is, this guy is freaking out. He's thinking, I'm in love with you. How could we be separated from that? How could we have so much space from each other? And then, you know, she was smart, I mean, to realize that you need space from each other to bring each other closer. And what I got out of it a lot is pretty much saying that, I mean, you really honestly have to be in love with yourself before you can honestly love somebody else. And that's, I mean, a great way to look at it. But that's kind of freaky to me to look at that, where that, I mean, you could be attached to somebody like that and married to them and have to be away from them. And that's a hard part to really to look at, as far as showing that I need a lot more work on meditation and sitting and to get to a point with that. It's a lot of work. And also where you talk about existing.
You're making a big job out of this.
It's a lot easier than I'm making up.
Gentlemen, did you have another question? Because the person behind you also had a question.
So. I ran out of my time.
What?
I did it my time. No, that's good.
Okay, but anyway, that's a wonderful image, interesting image. Yeah. And what you said is to love yourself. And it's interesting to consider, you may feel there's different parts of yourself when you're sitting you may want to get rid of. Like if you're sitting and you're feeling discomfort someplace. People in Zazen are famous for having discomfort in their knees. You might want to get rid of that. How can you even love that, the sensation that's coming from your knees right at that moment? Anyway, even that. How can you love yourself with all of yourself? Yeah. But the person behind you,
I don't know a lot about it. I haven't read any books about it, studied it much, but I have a different idea of more of it. It's a Socratic idea of mind and man, and the Freudian idea of ego, and the idea of the superego of having things that you really want to hold on to, like wisdom and virtue and goodness. The kindness, you know, these are the things that should be important. And I'm wondering here, what is the Buddhist teaching about the worthwhileness of
their wholesome qualities and
nirvana, are the, like you were saying, they're like at the same, almost the same line, you know, a ruler. I don't know what the purpose is of that. There's another experience that you pull it back into Samsara, the same thing, that you get there's an avenue, there's a process you follow called the Buddhist meditation, where you can reach this feeling or this attitude and things like that. I mean, it's, you know, it's a prevention from going to work on the, you got a tree to saw down, or nails to put in the roof of the tar paper, because it's leaking. It's prevention from
not acting in the world. It's almost like, well, you can't move.
If you get too much, it might over. The deal with this kind of material. But the deal, the worst thing, I think, is to wipe out the ego completely. And I don't know if they do that. So far, most people have been, and I've been looking at the times of today, if the ego is, this guy that...
Well, that would be going into maybe into the side of non-existence or wanting to annihilate something. So the Buddha is talking about the middle way. So not annihilating something, but not also just grasping onto something. Either one has its problems. mean, but it's a, it, you know, we do have our say relatively practical practice, right? Zazen and sweeping the garden or tending the garden. So that's putting the roof, putting the nail in the roof when it's leaky. Yeah, tending the garden. That's good. When I was actually at Tassajara, first practice period, I was there and I was sitting, and it started to rain. This was in the fall, and it started to rain, and I'm sitting there, and I hear people bringing in buckets to catch the drips that are coming from the roof in the zendo behind me. This was my first practice period. I know I'm not responsible for fixing the roof, right? Some, that's somebody else's job, but I'm noticing there's more and more leaks. Streams of water are beginning to run down into the zendo, you know. And for me, it was a big question. Should I do anything about this, you know? So finally, I got up and checked it out. And because I actually had carpentry training, I thought I could be helpful, you know. So yeah, it's practically, and we respond by seeing what's happening, and then take and see how we can help. Yeah. This is say every day, a mind. You realize the roof, the water. It's all, you know. On the one hand, it's completely empty. On the other hand, it's a leak in the roof. Let's fix it. Right. So then I did. The next couple of days, I climbed up on the roof, and turned out that someone had improperly flashed the gutters of the new dormers they put up. But any of you know roofing, right? So we had to pull off all the shingles and put in new flashing and put it together. And then for the rest of the practice period, no leaks. So yeah, we're not wiping out to say that it doesn't matter. Would be like to say, like you're saying, get rid of the ego. Say, leaky roof doesn't matter. Nothing exists, right? There's no roof, no leak. There is a roof. There is a leak. Same time, it's a sense of realizing that, this is how we've constructed it. This is how I'm constructed the world. And it's a world that I live in. So I want to actually live in the world that I'm constructing with you. But I know it's not the only way. It's not the only way thing, you know, and in a way it's conditioned by our, you know, all of our ideas. It's not absolutely true, but we have to function in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand. I still look at the two terms. You have two words that refer, in a question, could refer to the same thing, and that's simplicity.
Nirvana and samsara?
Nirvana and samsara, right. You usually don't have. So what are the qualities of the two things? Maybe you can look at the qualities that elevate different.
Uh-huh.
What are the parts involved?
So maybe we could have time for somebody else, Joe.
Sure.
Yeah, but that's that's a good question.
It is a good question.
Yeah.
Just following up on some of your explanation. So in your story about fixing the roof, in what part were you not fixing one?
Well, at that time, I was pretty busy. Yeah. Nowadays, I'm not.
When you were saving Tassajara from fire coming at you from three directions, how was the one not busy?
Yeah, that was it was intense experience. Great effort, but since we didn't know what we were doing, and I particularly didn't know what I was doing, I wasn't busy. it's kind of interesting, you know. I have to work with this, you know, a lot, because people assume that I'm busy. Say, oh, you're very busy. I know you're the abbot of Zen Center. You're very busy. No, actually, if I were busy, I couldn't do this. So it has to do with thinking, you know, am I doing something? No, not really. I'm just being here. So with the fire, you know, people were saying before the fire, well, you have to fight the fire. And then I was talking to the other students at Tassara saying, we're not going to fight the fire. We're not going to fight the fire. We're going to simply be there with the fire. And then we respond. Just as a friend, not as a... There's a big difference between, you know, if you think the fire is an enemy, then you really have to get busy. It's a little difference. And if you think the fire is just another part of oneself, then, okay, then you meet it as a part of yourself and you take care, just in the moment, you take care of what you can do. Taking care of oneself, you know, we didn't want for anyone to be hurt, so we were taking care of ourselves. Staying on the cool, wet side of the fire and offering some guidance to the fire. So I thought of the fire as just a kind of as a friend, you know, that needs to be greeted, in this case with water. And there's a difference, you know. So I have a very full calendar. It's hard to schedule time in my calendar. It's hard for me to schedule time to come to Chicago. I have an assistant who works very hard. I hope she doesn't think she's busy. But she works very hard to find time in my calendar for things, you know. So I have a full calendar, but at any given moment, you know, I'm just trying... practicing just being present with the moment, you know, what's happening or what's not happening. So this is to make the effort. The effort then becomes the effort to not go anywhere, not do anything, but the effort to not be attached to anything. So the effort then is to simply be present. And so that's a feeling of... kind of a unified feeling, not busy. So you may notice as you're, even as you practice walking, you know, we get up, we're going to walk and walk through the room, and you have a choice of having your mind already ahead of yourself or just being in your body as your body's walking. When I was working as a carpenter, I was practicing not being busy while producing a lot of work, right? To get paid for it. Right? Even have to get paid for it. So yeah, somebody else has to look at it and it looks productive, right? Otherwise you don't get paid for it or you get fired or something as a carpenter. So you kind of have to play along with this notion that you're doing something. Right? But at the same time, say I'm at this end of the building and the nails are over at the other end of the building and I need to go get more nails or something. I can just walk, and while I'm walking, I'm not going anywhere. I'm actually just there, walking. Pretty soon I'm, here are the nails. And so it's a feeling that but if I'm walking thinking I got to get to the nails, then I'm leading with my head. I'm already over there. I'm completely missing the experience of walking. So this is, you know, to inhabit your life is to be right at home moment by moment by moment. So when you actually know what's happening in the present moment, then you're not doing something in that sense of, I've got to get something over, you know, that's some distance from myself. But then everything is included. So, you know, there's a sense of a proper relationship. So I'd say, notice where you're leading from. As you're walking, are you leading from here? Are you leading from here? Are you leading from here? it's good to be leading from, say, about here in your body. Sense of being centered, present. See if this knows where to go. This is more of a unified sense of being. It's not good to just kind of get caught in one particular pattern. Oh, I'm always thinking about where I'm going to be, and then I'm going like that. You can get you can really wear yourself out that way. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay.
Maybe one more question or comment. Laurel, did you have something?
So, this is thinking about what you said about your not knowing who your wife is when she walks in the room. I had an experience just like that yesterday, talking in that room with someone that I thought I didn't know. And so I talked to him for 5 or 6 minutes and asked all the questions you ask a complete stranger. What do you do and where do you live? About 6 minutes into the conversation, I asked his name, and it turned out I knew him very well, but I hadn't seen him for 30 years. So the person that I had invented in those 6 minutes that I had talked with and not knew him was very different from the person that I knew very well. And then I had to put those two people together and try to figure out what had happened. It was a very interesting experience. And he
had the exact same experience, which we compared
notes on. We both made up a person while we were talking to each other, thinking we didn't know each other.
Uh-huh.
That's
good practice, actually.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we can continue meeting each other, not knowing each other.